This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 232. Today we speak with Jeremiah Montgomery about writing Christian fiction. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation in Reformed theology. This is episode number 232, and my name is Camden Busey. I'm very excited to be back in studio. I'm here by myself, though, but not just in person. I have a bunch of guests here over the internets, and I'm pleased to introduce them to you today. We have our good friend, Jim Cassidy, who is pastor at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringo's, New Jersey. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to have you online.
It's good to be back, Camden.
We also have Jeff Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation there at Calvary OPC in Ringo's, New Jersey, calling in from Windmore, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff. It's wonderful to have you again.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Just about 2 miles away, except we're using the fiber to talk to each other today. And we're very excited today to be welcoming across the Google internets, Jeremiah Montgomery. He was the pastor of Resurrection Presbyterian Church, which is an OP church in State College, Pennsylvania. He's also been a pipe maker, there you go, a blogger and an essayist. He and his wife have 4 sons, and he's joining us today. Welcome to the program, Jeremiah. It's great to have you.
Thank you, man. It's good to be here.
We're really excited. We're going to do something a little different than what we normally do. Today we're going to be speaking about Christian fiction and writing fiction. Jeremiah has written a book called The Dark Faith, which is a fantasy novel, an epic fantasy novel that is relevant for Christians today. We're going to speak about the nature of writing fiction from a Christian perspective, or Daryl Hart's favorite word, a worldview. And we're going to speak about what that involves in terms of being a Christian in writing, the use of symbolism, those sorts of things as we get started. But before we get into that discussion, gentlemen, do we have any announcements, any recent books or anything we need to mention before we get into today's episode?
Yeah, I'd like just to go ahead and mention the Banner of Truth Conference, which, of course, for 2012 would have ended by the time this is aired. But just to say that it was my first time attending this past year, and it just was a phenomenal conference. One of the keynote speakers, of course, was Sinclair Ferguson, so that helped. He was just wonderful, and so were the other speakers as well, including Ian Murray and Ian Hamilton, Jonathan Masters, who also gave some wonderful talks on what it means to be a godly minister. So anyway, I just want to urge some of our listeners, if you're an elder, if you are a pastor, minister, and next year, 2013, comes around and you are able, please think about spending some time at that conference. It's 3 days, they put you up at a college campus, and it's just a great time of fellowship. Get great and wonderful deep discounts on Banner of Truth books, and the learning and the refreshment that you'll receive is well worth it. So just want to encourage our listeners along those lines.
That sounds great. And it is wonderful to be able to go to that conference. We would encourage people to visit in the future and check them out online. There's a whole bunch of new books out recently. We're going to attempt to do interviews on several. One I would just like to mention, I think we've mentioned it before, Jeff, is Did God Really Say? And that's a book by many people from the faculties of Westminster Theological Seminary here in Philadelphia, Reformed Theological Seminary, which there are people from various campuses, Orlando and Charlotte, I'm sure, and I think others. And then also Covenant Theological Seminary, which is in St. Louis, or very close to St. Louis, Missouri. So check that book out. It's from Presbyterian and Reformed Publishers, an excellent title. I almost finished it yesterday. I'm going to be reading more of it today in preparation for our next interview, which is scheduled with David Garner, who is a professor here at Westminster, and he edited that volume. So among many new books, that is one particular one to note, I think, that would be encouraging and a blessing to many people who would like to read it. I'd also, of course, like to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported, and we rely on the generous support of all of our viewers and listeners to help us to continue to produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. Please pray for us and help us to continue to do our work and encourage us. We appreciate the comments and suggestions that we get by email. And if you're able, please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your financial support today. We do have expenses, and it's important that you help us to get this done. We're very delighted and excited to donate our time to the efforts, but at the same time, there's still costs that we need to cover, and we can use your support, and we thank you so much for everybody who listens to this program and our organization in general, Reformed Forum. Well, Jeremiah, it's great to have you on. I'm excited. I was excited to see this book. I've been reading some fantasy literature lately, and most notably some from J.R.R. Tolkien. Of course, many people have read the Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Hobbit. But we have a book here, The Dark Faith. But I suppose as we get into understanding what it means to write Christian literature, we might like to get a background of your biography and also what you're presently doing. I think that'll help us to understand and be enlightening a little bit in terms of your fiction. Can you describe a little of your present call and what you're doing up there in State College?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I've grown up in Pennsylvania. I'm certified Pennsylvania bumpkin. That means I get the privilege to tell all the jokes. I grew up here in central Pennsylvania, went to the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown to study computer science, and minored in philosophy and mathematics there. And Jim Cassidy was my pastor there shortly after college, so Jim and I got to know each other then. I was a little bit of a writer at that point, and actually we could go into this if you're interested, but the sequence of events that led to me working with PNR to publish this new book, Jim really had a part in that, interestingly enough. But after college, I worked for a couple of years as an engineer and then started taking some seminary courses part-time, but continued as an engineer, ended up being a software engineer for about 7 years, and then left that and went into seminary and just graduated last week, the week before last, the 18th of May. But since last March, and especially last summer, I've been working with the Orthodox Presbyterian Church plant here in State College in Center County, and we call our church Resurrection Presbyterian Church. And I was ordained in December, and my family and I moved up here a couple weeks after that, and we've been happily working here ever since. I don't know how much y'all or your listeners know about State College, but State College, Pennsylvania is one of the most interesting places in North America. It's it has the diversity, international diversity, of a major metropolitan city. Something like 55% of the world's nations are represented at Penn State University. And yet you have all of this in a very rural setting. So you can get over half the nations of the world, but then in 10 minutes be sitting on a mountain. I mean, you can drive. Yep. It's very contained. And I don't know of any place like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can get the diversity in the big cities. You can get the mountains anywhere out west, but you can't get it all together. So it's a really unique place. I refer to it as the crossroads of God's kingdom promises and his common grace. And it's really just an amazing place to be.
Wow. It is a picture symbolically of the eschaton when you see the nations coming to bring tribute on Mount Zion, the heavenly Mount Zion. So Lord willing, we hope to see many people come to faith through this work and through the preaching of the gospel there in State College. That's an interesting story you have, because I worked as an engineer taking seminary classes part-time before actually coming out here too, in engineering and software too. So that's interesting to see how the Lord uses people like us to bring us to do stuff like this. It's incredible.
Yeah, it is amazing how many former engineers end up in seminary.
You wonder, after years and years of doing what you do, maybe you long for something else. I don't know.
Which is better than unemployment, by the way.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah. It's true.
Well, Jim, would you describe a little bit about your relationship to Jeremiah, and I'll let you kick this off as we start discussing this wonderful new book and this new topic.
Yeah, sure. Be happy to do that. I got to know Jeremiah, as he mentioned already, through the work there in Johnstown, the Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church, where he and his wife were attending and became members of our congregation for a time while I was there. Jeremiah and I hit it off mostly, I think, due to tobacco. I mean, that was really our kind of the common ground where we began was pipe smoking and pipe making. He was the pipe maker. I was the pipe smoker, although he smoked pipe too. But we enjoyed a good deal of theological conversation over pipes and pints of good ale. So that was an enjoyable experience. And it was during that time where Jeremiah began to ask whether or not he thought he was being called to the ministry. He also had this unique gift at writing, and he began to write some things. It began to write a book there in Johnstown. I believe it's still available. Is it not, Jeremiah, called Soulmancer, a book that's been self-published? Isn't it available still on Amazon?
It is still available, yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah, yeah. So that was kind of one of my early exposures to Jeremiah's writing, and became quite interested in the way in which he was writing and the way he was implementing a Christian worldview. Daryl Hart, a Christian W-W.
Yeah.
And really enjoyed the way in which he was bringing the Christian faith to bear upon writing fiction. I encouraged him to continue down that path of being able to write and pursue ministry, and he has done that up to this point. So I'd like to hear from Jeremiah in his own words, kind of his experience with regard to his call to write Christian fiction, and what exactly led up now to the desire and the writing of this particular series, the first book, which is The Dark Faith.
Okay, sure. So I started writing fiction as a second grader, actually. I was in a reading class in my elementary school where for some reason, I was given the privilege of using the typewriter. You guys remember the typewriter?
Yeah.
And the typewriter was so cool because when you type on a typewriter, it looks like a real page, you know?
Yeah.
And so I remember writing an Indiana Jones knockoff story in the second grade, and the teacher was really encouraging of that, and that was really the thing that got me launched into wanting to write. And I think it was probably about that time I thought, you know, someday I'd like to publish a book. That would be cool. But it wasn't until the eighth grade that I read my first fantasy novel, and it was not J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, although I read that some years later. But when I first read fantasy, that first novel, I mean, it was just really gripping. And we can talk about that. I think you guys want to talk about that a little later.
Mm-hmm.
But the fantasy genre, I think, is really ideal for a lot of things and for discussing certain issues in a great way. But then, you know, it was kind of put on the back burner because life is what it is, and most writers can't make it full-time as a writer unless your name is Stephen King or Tom Clancy. And so, you know, it just kind of got put on the back burner. I went to college for computer science. My wife and I knew each other before college. We ended up going to the same college. Went through college in 3 years because we wanted to get married after college. So, you know, life just began, and we kept going. I met Jim. We got to know one another. We spent some time, as he said, exploring some of the gifts of God and talking about theology. And then it was in 2004 that World Magazine had a contest, a short fiction contest. It was 1,500 words or less. And I got World Magazine, and I had seen this contest, but had ignored it. And then Jim sent me an email or called me and said, I think you should try to enter this. So I said, okay. You know, and so on a lark, I wrote something and submitted it, and it didn't win, but it was in the top 10.
Mm.
And when you get into the top 10 of this contest, you get a letter from the publisher that they had partnered with saying, if you have a novel, we would like to look at it. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I didn't have a novel, but I had an idea. And I said, well, how long will you give me? They said, we will give you a year. So I wrote the first novel, Soulmancer, in 11 months. There was some pretty crazy schedule. It was three or four nights a week, starting writing at about 11 o'clock at night, because I had a baby at that point. My first son was born. So I was waiting till my wife and son went to bed, and I was staying up till 2 in the morning and then getting up at 6 to go to work. But by the time that book was finished, the publisher was not interested in it. So I sat on it for a year or two, then thought, you know, I've kind of been a geek about bookmaking and layout, and wouldn't it be fun to try to do this and self-publish? So went through that, did that, and Soulmancer, you know, is available. It's still available today. But through that process, the book became something that was more than just an idea. It was an actual book that you could get at, you could look, you could see how it was put together. And then whenever we exported Jim back to New Jersey, he also exported my book to New Jersey. And so when he got to New Jersey, he had a friend who was working with P&R publishers. And Jim can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Jim passed my book to his friend, and his friend then put the name in at P&R.
And, oh, that's
that was
Scott
my
Terlor.
First contact
that's right.
with P&R.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
That's right. Now I'm remembering all this now. Jeremiah's filling me in. I left so much out, and I had forgotten so much of the stuff, but that's absolutely right. That's right. That did happen. Yep.
And so they took a look at the first book, Soulmancer, and determined that they couldn't publish that one. They weren't going to publish that, but they kind of left me an open door, a little bit of an open door, and they said, if you ever have anything else you're working on, let us know. And I thought, well, this is great. Thank you. I was very appreciative of that. And I thought, I'll start making some ideas, and then someday when I'm done with seminary and life is sane and not stressful. This is before seminary, right? I had all these ideas. that someday I would write again. Well, it turned out that the summer before I began seminary, P&R contacted me and asked if I had anything I was working on. And again, nothing I was working on, but I had an idea. So I sent them a couple paragraphs. They asked for more. I sent them more, and that eventually grew and developed into the contract to write this trilogy, the Dark Harvest trilogy, the first of which is the first book, The Dark Faith.
Very nice. So now, would you be able to tell us then, Jeremiah, a little bit about The Dark Faith? Tell us, excuse me, basic premise, plot line, you know, fill us in without, you know, giving away too many details, but, you know, do whet our appetite for the content of the novel.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I've always been a little bit of a language geek. I'm not going to say that I'm good at languages, but I want to be good at languages. And so the main character in The Dark Faith is a guy who is gifted in languages, much like the main character in Soulmancer, if you remember, Jim.
Sure.
A different story. So anyway, this young man, his name is Mormus. Mormus was a young man whenever his father and his father's soldiers were murdered by a shadowy band of something in the mountains above his home. And these shadows, the practitioners of the dark faith, killed his family, but he miraculously, providentially survived, and he was secreted away then to a monastery across the sea. And his goal has been all along to develop the skills necessary to destroy the dark faith. That's his life goal. And he's been there for a number of years, and he's just not sure what's next. And then he gets appointed to a task that he realizes will help him achieve that goal. He is appointed to help translate Holy Writ, which is the revelation of God, from the common language, the language of the church, into the language of the people that live on the northern part of his island, where he is from. And that people on the northern part of the island, a barbarian people, he suspects are those who harbor the dark faith. And so by translating Holy Writ into their language and bringing the true faith into their land, he will also help expel the dark faith. So he's very excited about that. But as part of that, he gets involved in traveling with his abbot and a group of bishops and some other soon-to-be monks to the imperial capital for the triennial synod or general assembly of the church. And while they're there, things get scary. There are two sort of parallel dangers that develop as the story goes. There are children that are being abducted and disappear, And there also is a new religious order, an order of a new order within the church. I don't want to give away too much that that seemed to be making a power play. And so Mormus gets caught up in both of these events, sequences of events. And as he's going about that, shadows from his past begin to fall upon his path. He is looking through a library, and as part of that library, he sees something on a book that is reminiscent of the dark faith from his youth. And things get complicated from there. I don't want to say too much more about the plot, but things get complicated from there.
Yeah, don't give too much away. that's great. So from what you have described already, Jeremiah, there's definite clear interaction between, let's put it this way, your theology on the one hand, and then your desire to write fantasy fiction on the other. Now, is this going to then be, this is going to be a multi-volume set, is that correct?
Right, there are three volumes in this trilogy. the first, The Dark Faith,
not all trilogies
is supposed
do have
to be
three.
Out.
Yeah.
It's true. You know, it's an interesting comment.
David Wells,
there are
right?
some fantasy
That's
sequences.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
That's
and there
right.
are some
so
fantasy
now,
series in the secular world that
The follow-up question then is, what?
We're getting a little delay, so I apologize to the listener. Oh, that's the reason why this is happening. So, Jim, go ahead.
That's okay. What are some of the influences, Jeremiah, that you have, those that you have read growing up, those who have influenced your particular desire and gifts to go ahead and write fiction from a Christian perspective?
With Christian fiction, generally, you have to talk about the canonical works. I read the Chronicles of Narnia. I was in second, third grade, and then when I was 17, I read The Lord of the Rings. And then, even as important as The Lord of the Rings, the Silmarillion, the mythology that underlies it. I don't know if you may have read that, but when you read the Silmarillion, you see that The Lord of the Rings, the world of that Middle Earth, is not a rant. Is a world with order. And it's monotheistic, but you don't get that just from reading The Lord of the Rings. You have to read Silmarillion to get that. So that was a pretty important thing in terms of thinking about writing into a world that has a definite worldview behind it.
Mm-hmm. And what? How about any other particular fiction, perhaps secular as well, that has an influence, an impact on just the idea of writing fantasy?
Yeah, I would say sure. A series that I read later in high school, I haven't finished reading it because the series itself has not yet been finished, was Robert Jordan's The Wheel of Time, which is a really massive, epic work. But he was also very good at constructing very detailed worlds with nations, peoples that have particular cultures, and that was an influence as well.
Yeah, I had some friends that read through that series and were very fascinated with that as well. Just in general, just the fantasy genre, you talked about how it is suitable for this type of writing and for exploring various ideas. I'm very interested to hear how you think the genre is useful for exploring Christian themes in particular.
Sure. Yeah, I think that fantasy as a genre is particularly useful in that typically fantasy stories are epic in their scale. There's a clear distinction, usually, between good and evil, and both are taken very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I had kind of this existential moment in terms of understanding this. I think it was in The Lord of the Rings, although I'll tell you what, I tried to find the reference, and I couldn't recently, just last night, actually. But there's a time, I believe it's in The Lord of the Rings, when Frodo and Gandalf are speaking, and Frodo is expressing the idea that he doesn't understand why Sauron is doing the things that Sauron is doing. And Gandalf says, there is such a thing as malice in the world. And I just found that to be so helpful because it cuts through all the the therapeutic fuzziness that we see in our culture today. That Sauron wasn't misunderstood. He was evil. And fantasy is just such a great genre for discussing themes of good and evil And, you know, you take, you bring in the sinfulness of man, the sinfulness of angels, and you can be very realistic about it. And unlike other genres where people react very negatively against what they perceive as judgmentalism, in fantasy it is accepted. It's an accepted tenet of the genre, if you will, that there are going to be clearly evil and clearly good teams or sides. The other aspect of this is that fantasy novels, because they are epic, they reflect the epic nature of reality. We live in a world and in a universe that is supernatural. There is a God in heaven. He is mighty to save. There are people that are at war with him, the world, the flesh, the devil, and his minions. And so when we read these stories that are serious about the supernatural and serious about good and evil, we get hints, however veiled, however muffled, about the true nature of our own history. The human history itself is an epic story. It is a hero story. You know, Jesus, the Redeemer King, is the King who will return someday. And by faith in union with him and trusting him and living for him, becoming servants of the King, we can participate in this hero story. And so I think that fantasy is just such a good genre for drawing those parallels.
Now, my follow-up question, and we're kind of in that stage now where we're struggling with perhaps and looking for guidance on the question of the relationship between Christian worldview, your Reformed theology in particular, and then the writing of fiction. Do you find, Jeremiah, that there's ever, I'm sure there is, but do you find that there's a struggle with the question of how much do you veil your theology with the fiction versus how much do you unveil it? In other words, do you ever struggle with the question of how subtle are you to be in the communication of your theology without compromising it with entertainment value? Do you understand my question? Does that make sense?
I think I do. It is a struggle. If you're going to write fiction, and it's going to be fantasy fiction, you have to think of, okay, this is a fantasy world. And if you're a Christian, you want to have Christian theology underpinning it in some way. So how explicit do you get about the theological aspects? Is there a church? Is there a Bible? What do people know about God? And different authors do this in different ways. Tolkien was very in the background. He said, you have to read the opening chapters of the Silmarillion to see where he's going. There have been other authors that have tried to be more veiled, more or less explicit. But what I decided to do when I was writing the Dark Harvest trilogy is I just decided to have the church. You know, it's called the church. We call it holy rather than holy scripture, but it's the same thing. There is a Savior, and there's evil. And a lot of what you see as you read The Dark Faith is there are very intentional parallels between Dark Ages Europe and the history of the church and what's going on in my story. Those are intentional because I want people to make the connections with these real events, but also I hope as they're going to ingest the story and what I'm trying to communicate that they'll make other parallels as well.
That's good. That's helpful. Do you have any suggestions for our listeners? Perhaps somebody's listening who is an aspiring writer, an aspiring writer of fiction. Do you have any counsel? Do you have any books that you would suggest that they read? Anything that you would like to communicate to somebody who is looking toward doing what you have already begun to do?
For those who may be interested in writing, I think there are four main points that I would emphasize, and all of them have a theological basis. So the first is that our God is a God of glory. And so what that means is that stories should be glorious. You know, all of history is God's story. And so if we are writing stories, if we're writing fiction, we should write stories that are good. Cheesy fiction is bad. Bad fiction, even if you call it Christian, is still bad fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to write, especially as a Christian, you have an obligation to do it to God's glory and to do your best within your abilities, within your resources. Do your best, write to the glory of God. The second point is that our God is a God of order. He is a God of order in creation and in providence. Our standards talk about this. And what that means is that you have to have a believable world, and you have to have an orderly world. Especially in fiction, and especially in fantasy fiction, this is so important, because in fantasy fiction, you really bring in the supernatural element. And even if you're going to bring in the supernatural element, you still have to follow rules. If there's magic in your story, magic has to follow rules. And you, as the author, cannot break the rules just because it's convenient. You have to do the hard work to follow the rules. Fiction, especially fantasy fiction, is there's a sense in which I got this from another writer. I can't remember who said it. I think I read it in a book on writing.
Yeah.
I said that fiction is a contract between the author and the reader in which the reader is agreeing to suspend their disbelief for a time to listen to you tell your story. But if you violate that trust by breaking the rules, they'll stop caring about your characters. They'll stop caring about your book. So your world has to follow rules. Your characters have to follow the rules of human society, human culture, human nature. They should behave in human ways. They have to be realistic characters. So our God is God of order. That's my second point. The third point would be that our God is a God of truth and goodness. And so if you're writing fiction as a Christian, you need to make sure that you maintain clear standards of good and evil and that you take both seriously. You need to account the sinfulness of men and angels. You shouldn't be morally fuzzy. That doesn't mean your characters will never face moral dilemmas, but you shouldn't be morally fuzzy. You know, I think I mentioned this earlier in the interview, but when you read Tolkien, you never get the impression that Sauron was misunderstood. That he was just, you know, he was just a decent guy trying to make it, and he just misunderstood, and he's a victim of his circumstances. There's none of that.
Yeah.
He was evil, and Tolkien was clear about that. And so we need to, as authors, writing from a Christian perspective in fiction, whether it's fantasy or any other genre, we need to take the sinfulness and good and evil seriously. And we also have to take seriously the solution. This speaks to a question that I think Jim had asked earlier about how much do you veil your theology and how much do you make it explicit? C.S. Lewis had Aslan, the very thinly veiled Christ figure. Other authors will keep it in the background. In my stories, in the Dark Harvest trilogy, there is a church, there is a gospel, there's a savior. His name is Jesus, and people trust in him. And so I made it very explicit. That's part of what I'm doing in the story is I'm drawing intentional parallels geographically, culturally, historically between Dark Ages Europe and my world. The names are different. The countries are different. The peoples are different. But there are so many parallels. I want people to pick up on the parallels, and I want them also then to pick up on the parallel lessons that come out of my fantasy story but also exist in our reality. So you need to take these things seriously. What you don't want to do, and I think a lot of times people think Christian fiction is this, but I think you want to avoid it, is you want to avoid the cheesy, too quick, unbelievable conversions. That's not realistic. Again, you'll violate the trust of your reader. People should struggle. You know, people that are coming to faith should struggle. They should have to face the unpleasant truths about themselves and the good truths about God. You know, I have a saying that I like to use here in State College that you say to people, cheer up, first thing you think, but God is better than you imagine.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the gospel comes into our lives. And that's my third point. God is a God of truth and goodness. The last point that I would make for aspiring writers is that our God is a God of revelation. He is a God who gives us systematic truth, but he gives it to us in stories. We have systematics in stories, or you say we get the dogmatics in the dramatics. And so God always tells stories, but he tells stories that say something. You know, history has a point. I've said this earlier, but all of history is moving toward that consummation, towards the fruition of God to all eternity. And fiction should be the same. You should tell a rich story that has a real point. And so the first question you want to ask yourself if you're going to sit down to write fiction is, what do you want to say? What am I trying to say to the world? Now, you're going to wrap it in a story. You're going to, you know, bring in sub-themes and so on. But if you don't have something to say, you're not ready to write.
Mm.
And then if I can add one subsidiary final point, this is not on the par with the four big points, but the fifth point would be, I believe in using an outline to write, even fiction. It helps you to avoid rabbit trails that go nowhere. I mean, I've known I've known a guy who, a friend of mine who's a writer, and he's told me that he's had to throw away sections of stuff that he's written because it didn't go where he wanted it to go.
Yeah.
And I think that if you write with an outline, you will avoid that as much as possible.
Hey, Jeremiah, you have a unique position currently where you're kind of, you're wearing many hats, but two of those hats stand out. One is a writer of fiction. The other is being a preacher, particularly a church planting, organizing pastor. What is the relation between those two, if any?
I think that there's some overlap. I think that trying to become a writer, develop good skills, writing skills that that incorporate the points that I've said, learning to make sure that you're writing in an orderly way, has also helped me to become, I hope, a better preacher. Helps me to make sure that my sermons are orderly and clear. I talk about wanting to make sure your story has a real point. I hope that that helps me make sure that my sermons always have a clear point. And since we're writing from a Christian perspective, taking into account these great truths about God, that just puts it in your mind more often. And so when you come to your studies to preach, prepare, when you're pastorally counseling people, when you're working with outsiders, evangelizing, you these things are always kind of loaded into the flash memory, so to speak. I also think that being a writer and writing fiction has, by God's grace, enabled me to develop some skill in illustrating sermons and helping with apologetics in that respect as well.
Yeah.
Jeremiah, can you... maybe you've already noticed this, but a lot of Christian fantasy, epic fantasy writers tend to be drawn to the Middle Ages. Is that just a accidental, or what is there about the Middle Ages that seem to hold sway over both the author and the readers?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jeff. I think there's probably a couple facets to this. I think the first aspect is that, in a sense, every writer after Tolkien is following Tolkien.
Right.
And so Tolkien wrote in the Middle Ages, well, Dark Ages, and so people pick up on that. He, in a sense, defined the genre. I mean, fantasy is a genre about castles and swords and dragons and heroes and villains, and the most natural setting in our own history was the Middle Ages. And because writing has to make some connection with things that your readers can understand, I think there's a lot of parallels in that respect. That's probably the main reason for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating, just to me, at least.
Yeah, it is. It's just usually taken for granted that's what fantasy is. But if we think about Star Wars, that's more fantasy genre than it is science fiction. You know, it has science fiction elements. But those are really the two... things that draw me to those genres of fiction, the sci-fi and fantasy, is because they provide ways for authors and readers to explore philosophical questions and questions about life and the existence and the nature of things that perhaps is not always as suited for other types of fiction. The other fiction has its own strengths, but I think fantasy and sci-fi in particular are helpful here. Jeremiah, I was wondering if, as a Christian author, if it's necessary for Christian fiction, quote, Christian fiction, always to write about explicit Christian themes. I mean, is it necessary that a Christian author have explicit, like, conversions for a religious purpose in their books, or are there other themes and things that can be developed or statements that could be made about life and the world that maybe are not as explicit?
I don't think, I would say that you don't always have to have explicit conversions, except unless you're going to have somebody who was previously a villain become a hero.
Yeah.
I mean, the only way that God changes people is by conversion. But if you're writing a story about a person who is already a Christian, then you don't need, unless their conversion comes into it, you don't need to bring that in.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from the reality in our own Christian experience that some people can remember that they have that very conscious memory of when they were converted. Others more or less have, they grew up believing. Now we know that God regenerated them at some point, gave them a new heart, brought them to faith, but they don't have a conscious memory of that. So again, you don't want to force an artificial mold on your stories. I think it's more important that your stories as a Christian writer always reflect theological truth. Hmm. You always have to have that, for lack of a better word, a worldview in place, that you're always assuming, if not stating, at least assuming truths about God, truths about sin, truths about the solution, and truths about what it means like to live mm-hmm. as a redeemed person in a still broken world.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that's common with at least parents and their children being involved in fantasy novels or watching fantasy movies is the nature of magic, for instance. How do we draw out the very reality that we live in a world that's fraught with spiritual warfare, and we do uphold a supernaturalism, of course. But how do we present those ideas without delving towards children perhaps misunderstanding and getting more of an occultish type view of what's going on in the books?
Right. That's a great question, and it's the real tension when you talk about the fantastic genre, isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. that's the big question. I think the general rule of thumb that I think is suitable is that we should never seek to grasp power or abilities that God has not given us. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is if you've read the Silmarillion, you know that Gandalf and Saruman and even Sauron were actually angelic beings. And so their ability to use magic was not sorcery proper, where they were conjuring or that didn't belong to them. They were using a gift that was inherent to them. I think that's a very important distinction to make. That's the difference between a story like Tolkien and a story where you have human beings who are not given supernatural powers trying to conjure evil spirits and grasp at something which God has not given them. But I think that's a very important distinction. It's not sinful for us to use God-given abilities if we use them for His glory. But it is sinful to use God-given abilities in a rebellious way. It's also sinful to grasp at power that God has not given us. I would not want to read, I would not want my children to read a story where the heroes are grasping at supernatural power they haven't been given. I think that's where you draw the line.
Right. That's a helpful distinction. I think I'm wondering as well. I mean, just having this thought as we've been talking, we're talking about the relationship between Christian fantasy and the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages, of course, many of the stories, much of the medieval fiction was surrounded by this creature known as the dragon. I mean, a dragon. Dragons were mythological figures that had some prominence in the Middle Ages, and so there's no coincidence that we find them again in modern day Christian fantasy as it goes back and looks upon the Middle Ages. But I mean, it is interesting, I think, that the Book of Revelation, the main character and the main evil character in the Book of Revelation, the antagonist is a dragon. And so, I mean, I'm just wondering if you've given that some thought about the character of a dragon, the Middle Ages, the genre of fantasy and the Bible, maybe the Book of Revelation.
Yeah, you get these hints, don't you? As we read scripture, the early chapters of Genesis, there's those passages in Job, and there is, of course, the passages in Revelation that there was once a lot more epic aspects visible in our world. And I think perhaps one of the reasons that dragons are such a identifiable character, even in secular history, is that they probably really existed at one point. The fact that they're just all across human cultures. I mean, every human culture has a myth about a fire-breathing dragon. I don't know that that's necessarily a myth. I think that was probably real history that, was passed down and changed and expanded. But when scripture talks about the fire-breathing Leviathan and then the dragon, Satan. We know that that's not myth. That is truth. That is real, inspired, inerrant revelation for us. And I think it's no accident that since Scripture, special revelation identifies dragons with evil and with Satan, that human societies, even those that live in rebellion against God, because of common grace and because of, you know, that echo in their conscience, the image of God, that they would identify the dragon as a source of evil, or depending on the degree of rebelliousness in the culture, sometimes identifying him with the good.
Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe a final question to ask. You hinted at the answer already, but bringing together this idea of fantasy, writing fiction, and then the Christian worldview, along with issues of ethics, how would you counsel as a pastor? How would you counsel those perhaps who are teenagers in your congregation, or parents who have teenagers, asking about the reading of secular fiction, such as, for instance, the Harry Potter series? You've got, of course, the Twilight series. You know, things that are now really popular, right on the kind of front and center stage of our culture. How would you encourage them to respond to those types of pieces of literature that are out there?
Sure. Well, I think that I would probably reiterate some of what I've said here about where I draw the line in fantasy between what is okay and what is unacceptable in terms of grasping at power that's not God-given. But then I also think a good rule of thumb for a pastor or for a parent is, if you're not sure, if there's a question, you should read them yourself before speaking. And so I have myself, I've read the Harry Potter novels. I haven't read the Twilight series. As I read, you know, the Harry Potter series, I had read, before I read the books, I had read some pretty negative press about them. But as I read those stories, it seemed to me, I mean, Christians of good character disagree on this. It seemed to me that in those stories, the lines were always maintained. The ability of the various persons, men, women, young and old, to use magic was inherent. It wasn't something they had to do evil to get. And then the bad guys were the ones that were working the really black magic. So I would permit my own children to read those stories when they're older, because they need to be able to be discerning enough to know the difference between fantasy, reality, what is fiction, what is acceptable for us living in our world. But I generally would think you need to counsel them on what is acceptable in terms of fiction, and also counsel them that as parents, they're responsible to make those decisions, and they ought to read the books and assess for themselves. And if they have questions, if they're not sure, then we as ministers and even our ruling elders as well are there to be a resource, and we will try to work through and help them as we can.
That's an excellent point. Helpful. I think this has been a fantastic discussion, and I thank you for bearing with us and some of our internet connectivity issues, and the listeners as well. But the good old telephone ended up working the best in the end. Jeremiah, thanks so much for writing this. The Dark Faith is the first book in the Dark Harvest trilogy. It's from Presbyterian and Reformed Publishers. We appreciate your time, and thanks so much for your insights.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, guys. It was a real privilege, and I hope to talk to you again sometime.
How could people find out about Resurrection Presbyterian Church if they're near the State College area? Or, I don't know, if they're University of Michigan fans and they're visiting for a football weekend and want to attend worship.
Sure. Our website is resurrectionopc.org. So that really is the clearinghouse for all information about our church. We have maps to our worship services. We have articles that try to answer frequently asked questions about the church or frequent objections to the Christian faith. And so our website is really the place to find out more about us. And since we are not yet living in our own facilities, we do rent. It would be good to check that before you come for a visit.
Yeah, you might have moved. Oh, well, thanks for that. And visit them online, Resurrection Presbyterian Church, an Orthodox Presbyterian Church work there in State College, Pennsylvania. You can find out more about Calvary OPC in Ringgoes, New Jersey at calvary-amwell.com. reformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationreformationre some of our writings at reformation21.org, book reviews in particular, but Reform Forum, of course, is available at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs. You can subscribe to our podcasts and get audio and video downloaded automatically to your computer. And you can also comment and email us at mail at reformedforum or tweet us at reformedforum. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.